Hey, podcast listeners. On today's episode, we are going to be talking about some issues around sex and a Christian sexual ethic. And so if you are listening with younger listeners or with other people that you might not be prepared to have these conversations with, we'd recommend that you give it a listen first and decide if you want to share this with others. Could be a great opportunity to open up some conversation, but might not be something that you and your family are ready for just yet. So we hope you enjoy the episode and let us know what you think.
It's too late, Katie.
I'm just gonna
The teacher's passing out the test right now.
I'm gonna fail.
Put your books away.
What did you prefer, multiple choice or essay?
Oh, multiple choice all the way. What? Who wants to write? Not it. You probably do. You're a pastor. You have to write sermons.
I do. That doesn't mean I prefer to write an essay over multiple choice.
I have friends who prefer the essay over multiple choice.
That's ridiculous.
Oh, for sure. Ryan, my husband, would totally...
The argument is that you can make up your way through an essay. Like, you can kind of, like, talk around it and get close enough that they'll give, like, a multiple choice.
But what if you're not even close? They just get a zero. At least you got a 25% shot.
You can
just
guess on the multiple choice. Right.
Like, you know, it's not this
one. You got a 1 in 4 chance.
Yeah,
25%.
Right, for sure.
All right. Welcome back to the Beyond Sunday podcast. Mm-hmm. Where we are exploring how to take our faith beyond Sunday morning.
Dun.
This is Patrick Nazaroff. With me, as always, Pastor David Bowser.
How we doing, Patrick?
And Katie Phillips.
Hello.
All right, we all work together here at Word of Life.
We do.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting.
On good days.
Well, we still all work together.
Even on bad days?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I mean, even then, we still get paid.
Guess you got a point. All right. Well, that got weird.
Yes. Today we have two big things we're going to be talking about, kind of revolving around sexual ethics in the Christian church.
Yep.
We have one of our brothers and sisters in Christ, the United Methodist Church, has had a major vote regarding sexual ethics. And one of our own, ELCA, pastors, church leaders, I don't know what to call her right now.
She's a pastor.
Pastor?
Yeah.
Nadia Bolz-Weber has recently released a book all about challenging kind of the purity culture of the 90s and the Christian sexual ethic of the past.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So... But before we get there, I have some news for us to look
at. All right.
All right. Now, do you guys...
We need one of those, like, news bulletin...
I certainly could find one, but I think that was better. do you guys get upset over grammatical errors in emails or things that are...
Facebook posts? Yes.
Facebook posts?
Your and you are, yes.
Oh my gosh.
There and there.
Oh my gosh.
What about TEH versus the? So if they misspell the.
Wait, what?
What?
Like if you're writing the and they write TEH instead of T-H-E.
They write TE. They write te instead of the?
Yes.
I don't know if I've ever seen that.
I'll chalk that up to an honest typo.
Did I say
an honest typo.
Audio correct?
Auto correct.
Audio correct is what Patrick does after we misspeak on here.
People who correct your typos are probably jerks.
Okay.
That's not me. That's science speaking.
That's science. All right. So what's the science?
Science is telling you that you're a jerk.
Let's go.
Give me more than the headline.
The University of Michigan conducted an experiment.
Whoa. We can already throw it out.
All right. Being a grammar Nazi.
Buckeyes forever.
Maybe a pretty good proxy for a person's level of agreeableness.
Hmm.
All right. So they had 80 people read through a batch of emails with a lot of different, some had grammatical errors, some did not.
Yeah.
And then they asked what they thought about the people who wrote those emails.
Mm. Okay.
All right. And...
Okay, go ahead.
What kind of email was it? Like, was it supposed to be a professional email that was being written? Or was this like a friendly...
Look, my article is two pages long, so, you know.
I need more information. I cannot make an educated judgment of this.
Okay, well, anyway. So they were asked to evaluate the person based on their intelligence, friendliness, and other attributes, based on their ability to write these emails.
Okay.
All right, and they found that the people who are more jerky would see them more negatively.
Well, how did they determine that people are more jerky?
Okay. All right, that's a good question.
So the more errors you found, the more mean you were?
Yes. Yeah. Well, the more you held people's errors against them. Not the more errors you found, but the more you saw somebody's error in a piece of paper, and that made you think that they were less intelligent or less, a friendly person because of their grammatical errors.
Mm.
Interesting.
That is interesting.
So the more you hold those against the people, or the more you noticed, the more you thought poorly of the people. So, yeah. All right, and typically extroverts tended less to harp on people's mistakes than introverts.
That makes sense.
Yes.
Because extroverts are not worried about the little details.
Yeah. They were easier to separate a person's mistake from the core self. Introverts did not do as good a job.
Okay.
Because introverts are like, I mean, you're taking all those words in and you're like
Right.
People can't see the hand gestures. Yes. Hand gestures that I'm making, but you're just like circling it around in your brain.
Gotcha.
Yeah, there you go.
I don't know. It's a University of Michigan study. Don't worry about it, Katie.
I'm just telling you, science is telling you you're a jerk if you care about those things.
I don't think that's what science is telling us.
I think we're jumping to a lot of conclusions here.
Okay, hey, it's not me.
It is you.
It's science.
Oh, Lord have mercy.
Ay.
Okay, well, that's enough of that. So here we go, back into our main story.
Right.
We'll talk about the United Methodist Church first.
Sure. Okay. This is almost breaking news.
Almost breaking news. It's just over a week old, maybe 2 weeks.
In our podcast time, that's breaking.
Yeah, this is...
That's as late breaking as we get. We need at least a week to process.
Right.
We can put in a little sound like, breaking news.
Do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
Yes.
Well, the United Methodist Church recently held a major congregational event, church-wide event. And this is church leaders and pastors from United States, Africa,
around the world.
Asia, all over the world have come together, a global event, to decide on a couple of things. One of the things they were looking at is how they were going to approach gay marriage and gay clergy within their church.
Specifically, gay clergy in a... in a married relationship.
Yes.
Yeah.
Gay married clergy.
Yeah.
Yes. And they had a couple of different plans that they were proposing. So one was called the One Church Plan. This would be relatively similar to what the ELCA has a plan. This is the... they would remove restrictive language from their doctrinal books about gay marriage and ultimately leave it up to individual congregations to decide how they were moving forward.
Yep.
With providing protections for pastors and congregations that are... not fully on board with gay marriage or having a gay married clergy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Then there was more of a connectional conference plan. And this would be, instead of dividing their church systems by geography, it would be by theology. So they would have like a more affirming or progressive branch of the United Methodist Church, a more traditional branch of the United Methodist Church, and everything in between. And different churches would subscribe to those to define how they fit in to the global church.
Mm-hmm. Right. As opposed to currently, it's like, hey, if you're a Methodist church in Southwest Texas, you are part of the Southwest Texas, I think it's conference in the United Methodist Church.
Yeah, it's conference.
So you're part of that conference. But those conferences would become non-geographic and would become theology-based. So you might have churches from Texas or from Michigan in the same conference, but rooted in a similar theology or theological practice.
Yeah. And then finally, the traditional plan. And this would be more having a traditional view of Christian sexual ethics. So would redefine for the United Methodist Church's marriage between one man and one woman and leave less space for gay married clergy members and for churches to do gay marriage. So the traditional plan won. It was ultimately voted in by the conference as a whole. So what do we think about that? You know, on the surface, that we have one of our the largest mainline congregation, that would be the more progressive side of Christianity, would be the Methodists, and they are having this debate. So what do we think about how our brothers and sisters are doing?
So I don't know how closely either of you kind of watched this process. It's probably a nature of the fact that as a pastor, I'm just connected with those sorts of people on Facebook and things like that. So for the entirety of the time that this conference was happening, my feed was just flooded with articles and updates and this is what's happening and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, in one sense, it was... it was kind of like feeling like the ELCA felt back in 2009 when we were going through this process and trying to make that decision. It's, for me, it is heartbreaking to watch the way we talk about one another within the church. I think regardless of how this had come out, there was just so much pain from both sides of this issue. And that is a piece of it that's just really, really difficult for me to get over and to continue to watch happen. I think it's just, yeah, it's awful.
Yeah.
And since this was a global conference and and there were people from all over the world voting on this, I mean, you have countries in Africa that have laws against gay marriage and, you know, so maybe America isn't as strict, you know, that as Africa, countries in Africa are, and or various places around the world, you know, and so maybe some people, it's unfair to some people in America, but at the same time, if you look at countries who have laws against all of that kind of stuff, you know, it's just kind of, it's interesting.
I agree. It's ultimately, we can definitely walk away, hopefully, saying it's complex. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of factors at play here.
It is.
And some of those factors are, you know, I watched a video of, you know, of an African pastor kind of sitting up there and saying, hey, it's not cool to have these white, wealthy American churches coming and telling us how to do our own ministry in the context of our own nation. And I agree. To some level, I'm on board. And then at the same time, hearing pleas of hurt and heartache from members of the LGBTQ community saying, how do we fit in with our own church that we love? And I agree, and I'm on board, and it's hard. And so both those parties and both those places, I will say it's hard to find how we ultimately find space for both.
And I think it's sad, too. I mean, it's another place where LGBTQ people have not felt comfortable in the church and have not been able to be themselves and to be welcomed. And I think that's, I think the saddest part for me is that we are just telling, it's another, and it doesn't matter who it's coming from or where it's coming from. It's just another point where we just say you're not welcome.
And it doesn't even matter if it's Methodist or not.
Sure,
right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the church as a whole.
Yep. Anybody who reads a story who's not already in a church, right? If you're out in the world and you read a news article about this, you're seeing that, and that is, well, religion again. I'm out. I don't want anything to do with it. You know, it's not just harming the United Methodist Church. I think it's really harming the perspective of Christ's church across the board. And you know, I became a pastor knowing that the ELCA was a church that was committed to moving the direction of allowing same-gendered partnerships and marriages, and at the time it was partnerships because marriage was illegal, and now it is marriages, and we're continuing to move in that forward or in that process forward. And so, I mean, that is an important part of my theology and an important part of why I became a pastor, because I do believe that we are called to be a church for all people, but all people includes people who are not yet in that same theological place that I am, because 10 years ago I wasn't in this theological place, you know, and So I get that our theology moves and shifts, and I get that relationships are critical to understanding how God is at work in people who we might not be connected to or in ways that we are currently unaware of or are not understanding. And so I get all of that. And I feel like what this ultimately does for the United Methodist Church and what is hardest for me is that it cuts off the potential for a relationship to move forward. You know, and that's what I think my prayer through the whole process had been, that there would be a way for those relationships to continue to move forward, because I think that the relationship is what's central to the body of Christ being effective in continuing to spread the good news.
Yeah, I think it's a weird place for us to be, because not only can we say within ourselves, our sexual understanding of ethics can evolve and change over time when it comes to Scripture. Our culture is doing the same thing as well, and it's moving in some ways very, very rapidly compared to the previous 100 years. You mentioned 10 years ago, your point of view changed, Pastor David. Well, I mean, culturally, our point of view changed within the last 10 years. I remember in 2008, Barack Obama, running for president, said based on his religious views, he does not believe in gay marriage.
Yeah.
He wants civil unions to kind of take the place of gay marriage or to rise up instead. And then by 2012, he said his understanding had evolved.
Yeah.
And so, and I think now the thought of a Democratic presidential candidate saying that is suicide. Yeah. That would never fly. Mm-hmm. So in 10 years' time, we go from president-elect can say those things, and now 10 years later, no chance can a Democratic or the Progressive Party, can they say those things and be elected at that stage?
Sure.
And so that means things have changed very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so I think for both parties, sometimes are dealing with the tension of this change very, very quickly, both the most progressive and the most traditionalist. Mm-hmm. And So I don't think it does either side, you know, a lot of good to look at the other with just vilification.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like, I don't think it's healthy for the most progressive persons in Christianity to look at those who believe in a more traditional view of Christian sexual ethics and say they're just bigots, mm-hmm. or they just don't, or even they just don't want us here, which mm-hmm. may be putting things there that aren't entirely true.
Sure.
Now, that does mean they don't have the same view as us, and we don't necessarily get that.
Right.
Or they don't have the same view as I do, and I don't necessarily get that. And it also, for me personally, leaves out, I think, the most important part of the whole this question, and that's the space for grayness.
Mm-hmm.
That it's okay to not be entirely sure
yeah.
of how you yourself fall on mm-hmm. these places.
And, yeah. you know, same-gender marriages, gay marriages, are a relatively new issue mm-hmm. that the church is having to deal with.
For sure.
But this sort of gray area is not.
Yeah.
I mean, you can go back to the Book of Acts and the early church and, you know, the early church trying to figure out, well, okay, now we've got these people who were not Jews who mm-hmm. are saying they follow Jesus.
Yeah.
Do they have to follow the dietary laws that Jewish people follow? Do they mm-hmm. have to be circumcised mm-hmm. like Jewish people were circumcised? Some people were circumcised. Some people weren't. Some people followed mm-hmm. those dietary laws. Some people didn't. They found a way to be church together.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that that issue at that time was as divisive and heart-wrenching for them as in some ways this is for us now.
Sure. Right.
I bet so. I mean, because that would be a place where my Jewish identity is
yeah.
central and core to my being, and now
yep.
my sexual identity is central and core to my being,
yep.
and how do I make those things fit?
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know what's going to happen with the United Methodist
nope.
Church.
Yeah.
I don't know if there will be a great, you know, a schism between a progressive and a traditional party, if there will be individual churches deciding to branch off, if there will just be people leaving,
yeah.
or if they will live even in the midst of maybe having a plan or an ethic still in tension with this.
Yeah, I think, I don't know what will happen. I think what will prevent people from living in tension is that they're, as part of the traditional plan that was approved, there are disciplinary actions that are to be taken
yeah.
against pastors who perform gay weddings or who are themselves in a gay marriage. And
yeah.
so I think the disciplinary actions will eventually prevent them from
mm-hmm.
remaining.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see. We'll see how it plays out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is the United Methodist Church is not the first church to go through this and not the first church to kind of have a schism, a split over this sort of thing. I mean,
yeah.
There were branches of the Lutheran Church that split off
mm-hmm.
when the ELCA went through this in 2009. The Episcopal Church in the United States is no longer part of the Anglican Communion. I don't know exactly how that works because their piety is a little bit different than ours, but Anglican and Episcopal are now different than they
mm-hmm.
weren't before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are branches of the Presbyterian Church that have gone through this. I mean, it's an old story that's being told again and again,
yeah.
I guess. But I would say the United Methodist is probably, because, like you said, when we started, I mean, they're the largest
mm-hmm.
Mainline Protestant group in the United States, so it kind of hit in a new way for this
mm-hmm.
one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's particularly interesting because it was not a United States delegation that made
mm-hmm.
the decision. This was the first time that a church has gone through this on a global scale,
yeah.
Which is an interesting perspective
mm-hmm.
for us to have as well.
And if you're unaware of kind of any of the news, probably statistically, the global church, the non-United States portion of the United Methodist is probably what carried the traditional plan.
Mm-hmm.
That if it was just left up to the United States, I think it probably would have been a one-church plan, that
yeah,
first
one been,
that
yeah.
would leave it up to the church. But the global world carried it differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that probably puts us all in a little place of like, we believe, you know, probably by nature of being an American, that our worldview is the correct one.
Right. Sure.
And so how do we go into places and spaces that are different than ours and ultimately tell them how to live? Because that has not historically been good for the world
right.
or healthy for those communities.
Right.
And so, but so even if you're like, I think that what our worldview is the correct one, coming into a place that does not have that same and say, this is how you should live, is never really a healthy play to
mm-hmm.
go, coming in as an outsider.
Yeah.
So I think it's tough. I feel bad for our, for all of our United Methodist Church's members, brothers and sisters.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Whether you're progressive or traditional, I think you're both can be hurting on in
absolutely.
Light of this.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely.
All right, so now that we'll shift over to our second topic we wanted to take a look at today, and this is all about Nadia Bolz Weber.
Yeah.
She's kind of, I guess, the closest thing we have to, like, a rock star in the
ELCA.
If the ELCA
were going to have a rock star, this would be as close as we're ever going to get. Yeah.
Yeah, so she is a pastor. She founded a church in Colorado and now has since left the church to transition into something new, I guess, writing, speaking. That's kind of how she's transitioning herself into something new.
Yep.
And so she has recently written a book called Shameless. It's all about a sexual revolution. Sexual reformation.
Reformation. Holding on to that reformation language of Luther.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Sexual reformation on how we approach sexual ethics within the church.
Yep.
So if you're probably unfamiliar with Nadia Bolz Weber, maybe you've seen in the news this call from a pastor asking for people to send in their purity rings that they got from youth group in like the mid-90s. And Nadia melted them down to create kind of a statue of a vulva that she created out of purity rings. And this was kind of in promotion for her book. And so this... I have not read Shameless. Pastor David, have you read Shameless?
I'm about two-thirds of the way through it. I haven't quite finished it yet.
Katie, have you read Shameless?
No, I have not.
Okay. But from what I gather, and I've read a lot of interviews with Nadia on this, and I've read a lot of comments on some of these interviews.
That's dangerous. Yeah.
And she's obviously divisive.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I think for her, the big spark is kind of the purity culture from the... kind of mid-90s, kind of going after this purity culture that rose to prominence in Christianity. And I take it, that's not the only thing that Shameless is about, but I do think that was a spark in this direction, is what did we do then and how can we do a better job?
Do you all remember the purity rings and that sort of thing?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so we're both youth group kids from the mid-90s.
One? Yes, I did.
So maybe real quick, Katie, if you and I, and I don't know if you have the same cultural understanding, we can kind of express how we experience kind of purity culture.
Conversation.
I went to two that I can remember, like youth conferences.
Okay.
And this was
about purity.
Yes, okay. On this.
Like
a True Love Waits conference.
Okay.
And I went, it was not done through the Lutheran church.
Sure.
It was in a different denomination.
Mm-hmm.
And I went with a group of friends, and it was a group of like five girls.
We were
probably 13 or 14 years old.
Yeah, sure.
And we went to this conference, and somebody got up on stage and talked about how we need to wait until we're married to have sex, and just this whole presentation on, you know, true love waits. You know, if you really want to love your... future spouse, then don't have sex before you're married. I mean, I went through this whole thing, and then we all got rings that were promise rings, basically, that we would not, we would abstain until we were married.
Yes.
So yeah, well, I went to a couple of those.
I don't know the ring culture as well, because guys were not given the ring, period, and I just didn't remember it. But which finger were you supposed to wear the ring on?
Oh, definitely your left ring finger.
So you're supposed to wear it on the finger on which your wedding band would go. So this is like...
Right.
Okay.
I think the idea of it is centered around you're pledging abstinence until your future husband. Like you're already pledging commitment to that person.
Right.
Yeah. That you've potentially never, have not yet met.
Right.
So, yeah. I kind of experienced similar things. You know, definitely a strong sexual ethic within Christendom at the time. True Love Waits conferences, again, we didn't have purity rings that I remember pass out in our youth program growing up, but I definitely know we talked about kind of sex in a similar fashion. And this was popular. I went to a Christian private school for college to learn how to do youth ministry. And at that time, this one book was all the rage for all the girls, a book called like I Kissed Dating Goodbye.
Yep.
And this was kind of a branch off of this purity culture thing into you're not supposed to date anymore. You're supposed to court one another. And basically...
This was written by like a 21-year-old at the time,
A young guy who was homeschooled who wrote I Kissed Dating... And nothing against our homeschooled listeners.
Right. But that's just a piece of the story.
Wrote this book, I Kissed Dating Goodbye, and it was very popular, I think, amongst most youth group circles.
Yeah.
Because it was about, like, attacking dating culture going on. Instead of dating, you're courting. And how way that looks different is you spend very little time together one-on-one to not be tempted to push sexual boundaries with one another. And so it was very much getting the girl's family involved in your courtship, friends involved in the courtship, that it was much more, instead of an intimate experience between two people, it was much more communal experience.
Mm-hmm. Like a village.
Yeah, it takes a village, right, to raise a village. To raise a relationship. Yeah. Now, the author of this book, I can't remember his name offhand, has since come out against his own work.
Yeah, recanted, basically.
He has recanted. He said he was wrong.
Yeah.
He understands it did a lot of damage to a lot of different people, and has sought to depublish the book. So it's no longer in publication. He's no longer receiving funds when it is sold. So it could be out there, like, you know, used bookstores.
Sure.
Or bookstores could have copies of it, but they're no longer making copies of this. He's no longer receiving funds from it.
And when we're talking about, you know, he's now seeing, like, it caused a lot of damage. The damage that he's seeing and that people have shared is that for women in particular who were raised with this book and this expectation, there became a lot of shame attached with their sexual experience, whether that was them growing up and how they were hearing about it, whether it was them trying to figure out what it meant to be in a relationship with their partner as they were entering into marriage. Yeah. It did a lot of damage to a lot of people who were trying to figure out how to be a healthy sexual being that is in any married relationship or whatever that relationship might look like. This book hindered a lot of that process for them.
Yeah, because I think a lot of it wasn't just solely on a sexual ethic. It definitely came a lot out of guilt and shame was the driving force of a sexual ethic. So,
and I think that was pervasive throughout the 90s and and the early 2000s even now. That's our fallback as a church when we want to prevent people from doing X, Y, or Z, guilt and shame.
Yeah.
Right? And that's where we go.
Yeah, I think it came, from a baby boomer generation that did not talk about sex at all, or maybe were part of the sexual revolution of the hippie culture of the 70s, and they were, you know, born out of a repressed culture that did not look at sex on any level. I mean, like Lucy and Ricky slept in separate beds, even though they were married.
Right.
You know, that was the world that they were kids in, so they kind of grew up into a more sexual revolution world. And so this was like, we got to talk to our kids about sex, but we don't want them to have sex.
Right.
And so, like, how do we do that? And so, I don't know, Katie, if you experienced this, but I remember, you know, things kind of centered around, like, this idea of, like, girls, modesty is so important. Mm-hmm. How you dress, because you're tempting the boys around you with your body. Mm-hmm. Was that kind of, like, spoken to you or you've experienced?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think, you know, I remember, like, you know, beach trips as a youth group or going to places, and it was very high of, like, what are you going to wear? You know, what do girls typically allowed to wear? Boys had less restrictions.
Right.
And, you know, I think for a variety of reasons, but ultimately I did not have the same level of restriction as the females in our youth group. And I think it also came out of these analogies that I think were, I'd like to say well-meaning, but were really damaging.
Yeah.
And that was like, you're like a stick of gum and nobody would want chewed gum. Like, did you experience or remember any of these analogies when you were growing up, Katie?
I don't really know. I mean, I don't remember any specific analogies.
Do you all remember the spit in the cup?
Yes. That there was a...
you get a cup of clean water.
And you could see.
And you pass it around and everybody spits into the cup.
Yeah.
And then the last person in the circle, now you take a drink of that.
Right.
Well, if you have sex before you're married, your husband's going to think that you're like this cup that's been spit
into. I do remember that.
Yeah. Or I know, you know, I definitely saw one, like, passing around a rose, and as you pass it around, it falls apart, and then, like, it's just kind of this dead thing at the
end. Beauty and the Beastie.
Yeah. Yeah. Or a used car. I mean, like, I think just real...
There is no shame in used cars.
But I think really terrible analogies, and I think part of the terrible analogies came from, one, they made assumptions about the room. Our youth leaders and pastors were making assumptions about the room that were not probably true, and that is... All of us are virgins in this room. All of us came to youth group at 16 or 17 years old, sexually, I'm going to use air quotes here, pure. And now it's to preserve that pureness that they still have.
Right.
And that wasn't always the case. Some of these kids were coming having experienced sex, currently experiencing sex on a wide variety of levels.
Right.
Some consensual, some not. And hearing these things can lead to a very destructive imagery of like, well, I've already chewed gum. My husband is already not going to want me. Why continue onward? Why try to be better? I've already crossed too many lines.
What difference does it make?
So what difference?
This was not particularly pervasive within the Lutheran Church, at least as so far as I grew up in it. But there was no room for grace in these teachings. I mean, this was like the absolute. Uh-huh. If you cross X boundary, right? If you allow a boy to touch you here, or if you kiss a girl here, you're done, and it's over. Like, there's no room for grace. There's no room for us to think about healthy relationships. It was all just, don't do it, mm-hmm. don't do it, don't do it.
Yeah.
And it was fear driven, and it resulted in a lot of people having lasting feelings of shame and guilt and mm-hmm. Anger and resentment, and even damaging their eventual potential healthy relationships with their spouse because mm-hmm. they did not know how to handle a healthy sexual relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it definitely led to some people getting married as virgins mm-hmm. and still not having the healthy, great sex life that they were promised in youth group.
Yeah. Right.
That they just didn't quite know how to handle adding sex to their relationship because mm-hmm. everything about their relationship was preventing intimacy, physical intimacy.
Yeah.
And now you say some words in front of a pastor and now you walk away and you're like, and now everything changes. And that was hard to shift mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. for, I think, a lot of people. So not only did it create, I think, a lot of guilt and anxiety for people, I think it also created a lot of stress mm-hmm. and fear, even in the context of a healthy relationship. Mm-hmm. And so I think the absence, like we said, the absence of grace really fed into this.
That's
your sexual ethic was the ethic for you as a Christian.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. everything else kind of faded into the distance beyond that.
And there's an element of this that, from my perspective, I think got fed into by Christianity in the United States' response to public education and what public schools were doing. I was part of a team in college where we were in an experimental psychology class. And so the point of the class was to learn how to do psychological experiments. And usually you did things on lab rats, but this particular year we got to partner with a group and go in and actually teach sex education to fifth and sixth graders in at-risk populations around Columbus. And I mean, one, it is a terrifying prospect to go in and talk to a 12-year-old about sex who probably knows more than you. Like, I mean, that's just a weird experience to be mm-hmm. at. But two, what we had to do as part of this project was read like 50 different articles of experiments that had been done about different forms of sexual mm-hmm. education. And what was being pushed by the main Christian political arm at the time was that all public schools need to be teaching abstinence only.
Yes. Like
that's what public education mm-hmm. needed to be about, was abstinence or nothing. And the problem was that study after study was showing that abstinence-only education within the public schools was only increasing the levels of sexual activity among teenagers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in increasing the levels of sexual activity, it was increasing unsafe sex. And so mm-hmm. it was resulting in more unwanted, or no, I shouldn't say unwanted, excuse me, more teen pregnancies, mm-hmm. more transmissions of sexually transmitted infections and diseases. And so all these risk factors were increased in populations that were having this abstinence-only education. But this is what the church kept pushing. And in some mm-hmm. ways, I think the church was pushing this because we didn't know how to have these conversations mm-hmm. in a healthy way with our kids in our own context. And so we wanted somebody else to do it. Why not make the schools do it? Rather than letting the public schools do the thing that they should do, which is educate people on issues of public health and public safety, because not everybody in your classroom is going to a Christian church. Not everybody mm-hmm. in your classroom is going to wait mm-hmm. until they are married to have sex. You as a parent and you as a community of faith, and I say this including ourselves, not to mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. condemn some ubiquitous you, but all of us have the responsibility to teach those responsibilities mm-hmm. to our kids in such a way that they mm-hmm. can enter into that conversation mm-hmm. and still come out of it in a way that feels healthy and safe to them.
Yeah, I think our parents at that point were asking, who's going to talk to my kids about sex? Me?
Yeah. Anybody but me. Yeah.
I'll let the teacher or the youth pastor talk to them about sex, and I want to make sure they're going to say the things I want my kids to believe, so I'll force them to say those things versus having those one-on-one conversations.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit about Shameless.
Yeah.
If you can give us a breakdown, because I have read some interviews with Nadia, and mm-hmm. I can say I disagree with her on some things.
Yeah.
I know, and that's a dangerous thing to say within the ELCA. I stand against the rock star Nadia Biltz-Weber. But I'm anti-purity culture,
mm-hmm.
but I do disagree with her. And so why don't you...
So the premise of the book, right, coming out of that response to purity culture is saying that if we imagine the Christianity's response to sexual ethics as kind of a pendulum, that we have swung so far over into the purity side that we do not know how to have these healthy sexual relationships anymore. And her encouragement, at its core, I think, is to help the church have a dialogue about having healthy views of sexual relationships because healthy sexual relationships are a part of our gift from God. They are a part of our created being. We are intended to have these. We are called to be fruitful and multiply. This is all part of the experience that we have in Scripture, that sex is supposed to be a healthy experience that can draw us closer to another person and can even draw us closer to God in its best. I think she wants to help that pendulum swing back. I would be willing to agree with you, Patrick. There are areas where not having entered into a dialogue with her, simply reading words on a page and words in an interview, I feel like perhaps she is swinging that pendulum further than I'm comfortable with. But I would recommend people read the book, if for no other reason than it helps us start to think about this conversation. You know, kind of what she does throughout the book is share stories of people in her congregations. So these are personal stories that people have walked through and how they have been hurt or injured or struggled with issues around sex and sexual ethics. And what does that look like? And what would a alternative Christian response be to those issues? And, you know, she kind of points how history has shifted around these things, how theology has shifted around things. And she kind of wants us to draw back to say, we are at our beings, or at our core, created beings of God that are intended for good things. And there are good things in this world all around us. There are delicious foods. There are wonderful vistas to go out and see in the mountains and on the beaches. There are incredible relationships to enter into. There is great sex to be had. I mean, that's kind of her argument. All of these things at their core are morally neutral. And it's the abstinence from or the indulgence of that can result in danger. So, you know, sleep is important. The right amount of sleep is important. Too little sleep, too much sleep, both bad things. Food, same way. Too little, too much can be very bad. She has a the chapter that I'm in right now is all about kind of a combination of pornography and the development of the candy and fructose corn syrup era, right? And it's like how these both of these things have kind of escalated together. Not that they're really connected, but just kind of using them as a parallel story for one another around how can we appreciate the deliciousness of an apple when we're so used to having this high fructose thing that's just so oversweetened that our taste buds are dulled to the natural goodness and sweetness that is around us. Using that as a parallel imagery to relate to the pornography industry, right? How can we appreciate the beauty of our middle-aged partner who's been with us for 20 years when we are flooded with these images of over-perfectionized 20-year-olds and doing whatever? You know, and so kind of using those as parallel stories. So, I mean, there are plenty of areas where I would want to enter into conversation with Nadia to say, what is this? What is this at its core? What are you trying to get at here? Because I think that she is drawing out really healthy conversation. She wants to draw the church back into an area that the Lutheran church has traditionally tried to hold ourselves to, of living in tension between two ideas, kind of like we were talking about with the United Methodist Church early, that we want to be in that gray area where we can be a church together. But I think there are definitely areas where she is willing to go further than I might be willing to, than others might be willing to go to. But I think the book is worth reading, if nothing else, as a, wow, I never thought of that before. You know, she has a chapter about abortion and how abortion became the kind of right-wing evangelical issue to live or die by. And points to evangelical authors of the 60s and 70s who wrote about life starting at the first breath, right? So life starts when you're born, because that's when the breath of God enters you. And there are all these ancient practices that go into this belief that the breath of God enters you at when you're actually born, when you take that first breath, and how that shifted as a political movement, not necessarily from her viewpoint, a theological movement into where we stand today with the pro-life movement. And so, you know, it's information to consider. This is not to say that she's right, or that this is the end of the argument. It's to progress the argument forward and is really to move us out of this idea that we have to be ashamed of our sexual nature.
And I think that's the whole purpose of this. You know, there's been shame around sex, and there's been, we don't talk about it. It's not secret, but you know, it's just not something that's out there for people
to
discuss.
For many people, it is secret, right?
Yeah. And just opening that door and just saying, okay, you can talk about this with your children. You can talk about this with your spouse, heaven forbid. Yeah. You know, I mean, that's a huge thing. Mm-hmm. There's people I talk to today who are my age. They're like, yeah, I don't have conversations with my spouse about that. And I'm like, oh, you should. You yeah. really should. Like, mm-hmm. you know, right. I mean, it can be great, you know, and you don't have to feel bad about that. Or in there, because there's this stigma around it that, I mean, I grew up with, you know, and it took me well into my marriage to go, okay, this isn't a bad thing. Like, this is okay. Like, I'm not breaking any laws. I'm not right. giving, you know what I mean? Like, but there was shame around that. And something that I had to, you know, get over.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think for me, with Nadia, and I have not read Chandler's stuff. I've only read interviews with her and kind of seen how she has approached this topic. It seems a little bit, I would say, throwing the baby out with the bathwater, mm-hmm. from what I've seen. Like that, the purity culture, this strong sense of guilt and shame driven sexual ethics is wrong. And so, from what I have read and seen, she's throwing out a lot of this Christian right. sexual ethics attached to that. And I would disagree with that. I think there's tremendous value in the church being set apart. Mm-hmm. And that's a big mm-hmm. thing, you know, that is happening in Scripture. And the Bible does talk about sex. Now, sometimes it's weird and awkward and we don't quite understand it, but it is part of that scriptural narrative, is how we approach sex. Mm-hmm. And so I think it is important for us to kind of still hold to maybe a strong sexual ethic, but with ample room for grace and love and understanding attached to that. So telling a teenager your future spouse is not going to love you if you're not sexually, again, quotes here, pure, is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Like, that's so damaging and hurtful. And also, probably not even true.
Right.
Like, that's probably not even the theological case or what's going to happen to them. And that just only creates anxiety and stress mm-hmm. in people. But I think saying to teenagers and kids, the best possible relationship, the best realized physicality in a relationship is through commitment, mm-hmm. is through these things, I think is okay. For mm-hmm. me personally, I think that's what I teach, and that's what I mm-hmm. like about, I think, the Christian sexual ethic. It is a response to the culture around us, and I think it is a healthy one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that Nadia might not say, I want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but I'm going to read a chapter for us, a paragraph from her first chapter of the book. It says, I propose a sexual reformation for those who have been hurt. I also propose it for those who have done the hurting, for those who doubt my authority and those who are certain they know all there is to know about God, what God thinks of sex. It's time for us to grab some matches and haul our antiquated and harmful ideas about sex and bodies and gender into the yard. It's time to pay attention to what is happening to the people around us and to our loved ones, and it's time for us to be concerned. I'm not suggesting we make a few simple amendments. New wine and old wineskins ain't going to cut it. Mm-hmm. I'm saying let's burn it down and start over, because it's time. So I think she would be willing to say that it's not enough to just shift. It's like, hey, we've got to throw this out because there's so much damage that's been done. We've got to throw this out and rebuild it from mm-hmm. the beginning. I don't know that she would go so far as to say, hey, we're going to, you know, throw the baby out. I mean, the baby for her is the Christ child, right? That's still sure. held in the gospel, and that's still held at the center of her core Lutheran beliefs. And so I don't think she's going to throw that out. But yeah. I think that as far as this purity culture, as far as our conversations around sex, she's really saying, get rid of it, and we got to start over, because this mm-hmm. this is not working, and mm-hmm. it's causing more harm than it is good. Mm-hmm. And I think she would even go so far as to say, you know, just saying it should be in committed relationships and things like that can be dangerous. And we're not that it's wrong to say that, but that we've been doing it in such a way that the message is not being heard mm-hmm. in a healthy fashion. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I guess then the question would come up: well, what can you say then?
Yeah.
What do you say? If you can't say you should have sex in a committed relationship, what can you say about it?
Well, I think that's her argument, is that we need to rebuild the theology and figure that out mm-hmm. in a way that's
healthy. Or we do say that, and we just have grace for those who come in and are like, well, I didn't, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, and then you yeah. say, okay, you know what? Jesus still loves you, even though you didn't, you right. know? Do you want to mm-hmm. learn more? Do you want to, you know what I mean? But leave yeah. that space, because that wasn't left for us in the 90s. You know what I
yeah.
mean?
Well, I think that it's hard to we don't have the answer yet.
Right.
I guess would be the way. Right. So, you know, Patrick, I feel like you're asking, well, what's the end result going to be, right? What's the new framework that I'm supposed to use? And her argument is not that we have the framework yet, mm-hmm. but that we have to throw out this original framework so that we can rebuild the framework and figure out what it's going to look like.
Sure.
So she doesn't necessarily, I haven't finished the book. Maybe this comes in the last chapter, but she hasn't yet said, here it is. This is how we should do it.
Yeah.
It's basically saying this is the damage that has been caused by what we've been doing.
And let's have a conversation.
And let's figure out something.
Sure. I think this is where Nadia and I would diverge.
Yeah, I get that.
We would want to shift. Now,
and I don't want to sound like I'm just defending her position. I'm defending the act of, hey, we might need to throw this out. That's what I'm defending.
Sure. Yeah.
Right. Sure. One of the things that we do here within our teenage program, our confirmation program, we have a class and talk about sex.
We do.
I lead this, and I typically try to approach this pretty seriously with our kids. And there's really two questions that our kids ultimately ask during this time. We have a chance for them to write down questions, and I kind of go through how we respond to those things.
Yep.
And we have both talked about those two questions, because this is what our kids want to know. What's the theology with gay and lesbian people,
mm-hmm.
and how far is too far in a relationship? Those mm-hmm. are the two things that mm-hmm. they are at their forefront. So I can sympathize with Nadia saying everything needs to be torn down to start over. But our kids right now are asking those questions.
Yeah.
And I want to give them an answer. I want to give them direction and guidance that's mm-hmm. helpful and good and helps them live their lives the best. So for me, again, I don't know if we have necessarily time for the next 50 years to experiment and figure out what works.
Sure.
Because our kids right now are asking those questions. And mm-hmm. they will continue to ask those questions throughout this whole process. So I do think it's okay to pivot. And I do think it's okay to shift. And I also would say, Pastor David, you've heard my talk on this. I probably approach this more conservatively than I may even believe when I talk to kids.
Hmm.
And I think because I just find it easier for our more liberal parents to pull back from our talk than our more conservative parents have to add to our talk. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, it's harder for the conservative parents to come in and say, like, no, he was wrong, and it should be more strict.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I just think that those things are. But
and conservative and liberal, we don't even necessarily mean that within the context of a political identity.
Yeah. I
mean, this is how parents view
a more traditionalist
sex and sexual relationships. Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
But I can also tell you, parents have a lot of anxiety about this talk.
Sure. My daughter is 3, and I already have anxiety about the mm-hmm. potential of having it. Because,
absolutely.
I mean, like, you know, at 3, we're having to start talking about personal space.
Yep.
And, like, what does it mean that, you know, I have space that other people aren't allowed to touch and that I'm not supposed to touch on other people? And, mm-hmm. you know, and that's already a weird conversation mm-hmm. to start figuring out. And I know that the things that I'm saying now will have lasting implications. Mm-hmm. Not that I'm doing mm-hmm. irreparable damage to my mm-hmm. child as mm-hmm. a 3-year-old. I mm-hmm. hope that I'm not. But that, you know, the frameworks that I give her now are going to be the frameworks mm-hmm. that she is building up mm-hmm. over the
Absolutely.
Next 15 yeah. years until she's, God, 18.
I know,
oh,
right?
Oh, my God.
Yep.
All right. I just had a real emotional breakdown moment there. Sorry, folks. I'm back.
Good luck with that.
Thanks.
All right. I think to close off, one of the things I do want to say, too, and I think we can be a little disingenuous here. I think there are a lot of people who grew up in youth group in the 90s with purity culture who have great marriages and great sex lives
yep.
and experienced those things. Like, I don't think it was there was only one outcome, and that was heartache
sure.
and destruction.
Right.
I think a lot of kids did... They did bounce from this into something beautiful and wonderful mm-hmm. for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So just because I think it has a lot of potential for danger and damage doesn't mean every kid was damaged by
right.
it. And I don't think it means just like every person who voted for the traditionalist plan in the United Methodist Church, I think, does not equal their sexual bigot who's
right.
anti-LGBTQ
yep.
people in the church. I think those things can be very disingenuous when we make broad sweeping statements. Like
yeah, and even yeah. Nadia in her book would say, this worked for some people,
yeah.
but it doesn't work for everyone, and we can't assume that God only has one intention. For
right.
like, we can't assume that this is the only way that people can mm-hmm. exist mm-hmm. in the world. That's the mm-hmm. argument that she would kind of make with that mm-hmm. as well.
So I think we're all on the same page. Christian sexual ethics are pretty complex.
Yes.
I'm definitely on that page.
For sure.
And any person, a traditionalist or progressive, who says they have the answers, I think would be disingenuous.
Mm-hmm.
That I think that they're complex, it's tough, mm-hmm. and we're all going to fall in this gray space on different levels
mm-hmm.
and different places. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the beauty of, I think, sometimes a church that we say if the table's open for everybody, it's open for every person who has wildly different views mm-hmm. and ideas about yes. these things. And that's okay. Because I'm sure our listeners have wildly mm-hmm. different views and ideas yeah. about these things.
I would imagine even in this room, right? I mean, there's just the three of us here recording this episode. But I'm guessing we've got a spectrum mm-hmm. of ideas and
I can guarantee
visions
it.
Of what this looks like here, right? Yeah. Yes. So, I mean, this is not easy stuff. And we're mm-hmm. not trying to present this to say, oh, this is it. Now we're done. Mm-hmm. And so if you're listening to this and you're thinking like, man, I don't agree with anything they said, that's okay. And yeah, if you're right. listening to this and you're like, man, they really like spoke some things that I think are true. Like we might have, but that might not be true mm-hmm. for everybody. Like there's just so much mm-hmm. stuff that we're still trying to figure out. The best thing that I can recommend through this is to have open conversation.
Absolutely.
And yeah. so if you are in a place where you are raising a kid or where you're uncertain of your own relationship, whatever that might be, find someone that you mm-hmm. can talk to mm-hmm. and start having dialogue because the one thing that has been most harmful, I think, has been this idea that it has to be a secret, that yes. it can't be something that we talk about, that we can't express our own wants or desires, we can't express our own fears or anxieties because mm-hmm. those things are shameful. And, mm-hmm. and that is really harmful to everybody.
Absolutely.
I think that brings us to our recommendation.
Mm-hmm. All right.
I'm Katie Phillips. You have a recommendation for us?
Here we go. I do. What do you got?
So I have a podcast recommendation.
Wait a second.
I know.
You're implying that people should listen to something other than Beyond Sunday?
I assume they just have us on a loop.
We're the only ones they listen to.
Right when this one is done, they just start the next, you know, yeah. they just go back to the catalog and just keep going. Yes.
Don't listen to episodes 1-5. Just skip those.
Save yourself.
They listen to them over and over again. So my recommendation is a podcast called Sexy Marriage Radio. And it has all kinds of topics and conversations around sex and what that looks like in healthy ways, not so healthy ways. They give lots of advice. It's a husband and a wife who mm-hmm. are doing the podcast together. Some things you might not agree with, some things you might agree with. It's just interesting to listen to and can possibly open up conversation in your marriage.
So, Sexy Marriage Radio.
Sexy Marriage Radio.
Is it from a religious perspective or just a healthy married relationship?
I'm going to say healthy marriage relationship. They are Christians. They do say that several times,
sure.
but not necessarily in every episode. So it mm-hmm. kind of depends on what episode you're listening to.
Okay.
Sometimes it's more of a Christian view and sometimes it's not. It just kind of, I mean, there's an underlying...
But sure. Just because you're a Christian doesn't mean you have right. to talk about Jesus all the time.
Right. You know, like. Right, exactly. You know what I mean.
Sure. I get it. It's okay.
You had such contempt in your voice when you said Jesus. That
is. Well, I think sometimes, like, you know. And,
you don't have to talk about Jesus.
This is, you know, maybe we'll cut this. But, you know, I feel like any, like, Christian musical artist who ever releases a song that's not explicitly about Jesus.
Right.
Sometimes
right.
the Christian community is like, what? They're sellouts. And I'm like, the Christian right. faith has a lot to say about everything.
Right.
You can be a Christian right. and write a screenplay that is not directly related to faith.
Right.
Yeah.
And still be influenced by your faith. That's yep. ridiculous.
But it's definitely within the context of a marriage. And some episodes are about talking to your children about sex and how you handle different topics with them. So it's all over the place. Yeah. But, you know, it's interesting.
Great. The other recommendation on that, talk to your kids about sex.
Yes, talk to yeah. your kids.
Because they're talking to somebody about it.
And yeah. I think that, too, like Pastor David said, he's talking to his 3-year-old about personal space. I mean, it can start when they're 3. It can start when they're 2. And teaching them little things yeah. along the way that will eventually build up, hopefully, to a healthy sexual relationship.
All right. Sexy Marriage Radio. That brings us to the end of our podcast. How can you find us? Pastor David, you yeah, are in charge of this stuff.
I am. Hey, you can find us at beyondsundaypodcast.com. You can send us an email at beyondsundaypodcast@gmail.com. You can send us all your thoughts and questions around this episode or any episodes that we've had. If you have other things that you would like us to cover, we'd love to hear from you as well. We're always looking for new ideas. Or if you have a story that you want to share that might be helpful to other listeners, we'd be happy to hear that also.
All right. Thank you so much for listening. See you next week.
Have a great week.